So yeah, I'm Phil Blossom. I'm actually from Oxford, but I've stolen these slides from Chris Dyer, hence the advertising for Carnegie Mellon University. And that will explain why I may disagree with my own slides at times. So we've got to the end of the week. So now we're going to talk about how to train or tune your MT model to maximize whatever performance metric you're interested in. And so, to start off, I'm actually going to very quickly go back over performance metrics and the blue score, because I think, I'm not sure anyone actually showed you the equation or the way blue actually functions. I think it's been mentioned a number of times, but I'm not sure anyone actually defined it for you. So I'll do that quite quickly. And then the second part, I'll talk about discriminative training. I'll explain what discriminative training is and a couple of models. There's a huge number of models in discriminative training. We don't want to go through all of them, but I'll talk about two popular ones. So firstly, evaluation. You've already had a talk about evaluation, so I won't labour this too much. But I will suggest a slightly different perspective here, that evaluation is extremely important for training, because if you're going to train a model, you're going to need to optimise something, and the ideal thing to optimise is the performance metric you're interested in. So there's a tight connection between translation quality evaluation and training of machine translation models. And this is something to keep in mind. And it also means that sometimes it gives us a slightly different perspective of what makes a good evaluation metric. So, as I said, we've been through this a bit earlier in the week, but obviously it's a difficult question about what makes a good translation, and there's lots of different ways you can judge that. And most of the time, we take a very simplistic view of this and use something called the blue score, which is basically just n-gram overlap with a set of references. So yes, blue stands for, if you haven't seen this, bilingual evaluation understudy, and it has two parts. It has a precision part, and that's the part most people think of when they think of blue, the n-gram overlap. But a key thing to also remember about blue scores is that it has a length factor, and you should never forget about that second one, and I'll show why in a moment. So a quick demonstration of how blue works on this sentence. So at the top we have our hypothesis translation. That's what our MT system has given us. We have four references produced by humans, and we want to work out the blue score for this single sentence. So we first look at unigram precision. So we look at that that quotation mark, and we look at how whether it occurs in the references. And then the second key thing here about blue is it has clipping. So although that occurs three times in once in three different references, we never match more than the number of times it occurs in any single reference. So we clip that. So we say that that has a count of one. And we keep going. We see that the extension doesn't occur in any of the references, so that gives us nothing. Of. So we keep matching. And you notice that we can match from different references in the multi-reference version of blue. And we match the end of the quotation. Then we move on to bigrams. So we look for bigrams. And as we go from unigrams to bigrams to trigrams, we're going to match less and less often. So we get one match there of ISI, ISI in. And we keep going and we get our trigram and four-gram precision. And for blue score, we normally always stop at 4 grams. So that's how we get these precision numbers. And then what we do is we basically take an average of them. So we take the logs down the bottom, you see, of all of our four different precisions. We average them. So sometimes you'll see blue described as having different weights for different n-gram lengths, but that's very rare that anyone would actually do that. Mostly it's just uniform average. And we exponent check that. So then that gives us our average precision. But that was the first half of blue score. And that's not the whole story. Because if we look at a reference like this, ISI in Uttar Pradesh, now clearly that's sort of a partial translation, so it's not great. We don't really want to say that that's a great translation. But if we look at its n-gram precision, it will be 1. So that, From an n-gram precision point of view, that's a perfect translation. So that's a key problem with precision. It doesn't give us recall. It doesn't say that there's a number of n-grams that we're missing. So we need to penalize short translations, because if we don't, then the easy way to get a good blue score is just to predict a few words. Always predict that, and you're going to get a 100%. So we need to penalize short translations. But we don't need to penalize long translations, because if you predict more words than there are in the references, then your precision is just going to go down anyway. You're making it harder for yourself. So we're going to get this one-sided... there we go. There's all the precisions. So clearly that's not what we want. So we're going to introduce a one-sided penalty on short translations. And this is what's called the brevity penalty. So BB there, we're comparing the length of the references to what we predicted, and you see we have this exponential penalty, which only applies, the key thing is it only applies if the
predicted
translations are shorter
than the references. Okay, so we put those two things together, and we get our blue score. But a really key thing to
understand about blue score and the brevity penalty is sort of summarized in this curve. So, as I said, it's one-sided. So there's this point on the left where the translation is longer, where the brevity penalty does nothing. It's just one. And then we get into this regime where we get this exponential penalty on the length. And that's actually really quite heavy. So basically, if you want to get good blue scores, you need to get the length of the translations right. Otherwise, you'll get a very big penalty. So that's a key lesson for anyone that's trying to win any MT competition or anything like that. You need to care about the brevity penalty.
It's also a key lesson
whenever you see blue scores, to also ask a question about what the brevity penalties are.
When you compare two blue scores,
it's very easy to gain
blue by tuning the brevity penalty without improving the translations. In fact, it's very easy to make the translations worse. So often you have a translation system that tends to translate a bit short than the references, and you'll get a bad blue score because of that. So you just stick in a length penalty, a fudge factor, and say predict some extra words. Decreases your brevity penalty, gets you a better blue score, and makes the translations worse. So whenever you're looking at blue scores, it's always a good idea to think about the brevity penalties as well, both in order to maximize your own blue score, but understand comparative blue scores. So when we put those two together, our short example there of ISI in Uttar Pradesh, we go from a precision of 1 to something much more reasonable, a final blue score of 0.3. So that's blue, two parts. But never forget the brevity penalty in blue, because a large part of the discriminative training we'll talk about is tuning that brevity penalty to get it right so you get a good blue score. So let's talk about discriminative training. Okay, so in lots of introductory MT courses, and I think you saw this earlier in the week in alignment, we talk about the noisy channel model. And this is because this was the way in the early 90s that the people at IBM motivated the generative translation models. And so the key thing is to remember is that we don't do this anymore, but it gives us a way of showing how we go from what we were doing 20 years ago to what we're doing now. So imagine this noisy channel view of translation, where we have some source that produces some English, and we can think of that as our language model, P of E. We stick that into a blender that messes it up and spits out German. And in translation, we want to reverse that process. So we see the German at the right, and we want to get back the English. So we want to reverse that. And we can do that easily using Bayes' rule. So we can take P of E given G, we can turn it around into P of G given E times P of E, and because we're only interested in the maximization, we're not going to look at the whole distribution over translations, we just want the one that's best. We can throw away P of G on the bottom and end up with that final argmax. So if you're not familiar with an argmax, that just means give me the E which maximizes P of G given E times P of E. So that's the noisy channel model. So that gave us basically, that said, if you want to learn a translation model, learn these two probabilities. Learn P of G given E and P of E. But if we do a little bit more manipulation, so we take our argmax, we take the log of that, so now rather than a product, we've got a sum. And sums are good because they're nice and easy to deal with. And then we can rewrite that using a bit of linear algebra into this matrix vector product. And that might look a bit funny, but at least when Chris wrote these slides, he thought you might find this familiar. Many of you probably don't find this familiar, but this is a linear model. So if you've done a course in statistics or linear algebra, this is just a stock standard ordinary linear model. It says we have some vector W. In the case of our noisy channel model, it's just ones, so it's an identity. We have some vector of parameters. In this case, they're the logs of our probabilities. We do that matrix vector product, maximize it, and that's the same thing as we had for our noisy channel model. So that's a sort of re-manipulation of our noisy channel model. It gives us a different way of looking at it. And the reason we might want to look at it this way is we can say, well, let's forget about the noisy channel model, and let's just view our translation model as some set of weights, which may be high-dimensional, and some set of parameters that we multiply them by. So now we're going to talk about W, our weights, and our function H there, our parameters. And so now we can say, well, rather than just two of these, let's have 10, 20, or 10 million. So another way to view this, we can view our, what I'm going to call now, features of our noisy channel model, P of G given E and P of E on each axis. So this is sort of a two-dimensional visualization. Each dot there might represent a translation hypothesis. And in two dimensions, we can view our vector W as a vector. It's just that arrow there. So if we view that as a vector, we can then look at which of the hypotheses is maximal in the direction of that vector, and it will be the one in the bottom left. And then that would be the one we'd output as the best translation. So that's our linear model view of our translation model. Key thing here is it's a linear model. You'll see lots of people write papers and talk about a log linear model in translation. They're just a little bit confused. They'd actually mean a linear model. It's just a historical artifact. So predominantly what we do is linear modeling in MT. Now, given that we might have a model that might predict that hypothesis, the obvious thing to do is to say, well, what is the best hypothesis? And maybe that green dot there is the best one, according to our metric, blue score, something like that, or maybe that's a reference in our references. So our model, in a sense, is wrong. It should be pointing more at that green one. So discriminative training is all about reorientating that vector W so that it points at the best translations. So that's what we're going to focus on. So that's the first key part of our discriminative training. How can we take our weights, look at what translations they produce, and then adjust them to produce ones that are better according to our references or our metrics on those references? So now, slightly more difficult case maybe that one is not after all the reference. Maybe the reference is that green dot just under the arrowhead. And now if you think about that in two dimensions, we have a problem because there's no way we can orientate that arrow such that that green dot's going to come out as maximal, because it's surrounded by other dots. So we have a problem. And the classic solution to that, there's two classic solutions to this in machine learning. One is to use a nonlinear model. So we could get complicated throwing a nonlinear model. Could be a neural network or something crazy, support vector machine. But that would be a bad idea. A much simpler idea is just to add more features. So in this slide, what we've said is let's add a third dimension. And in that third dimension, maybe that point we're interested in sits in a different plane to the other points, and now we can separate it. So now rather than a vector being our W is actually a vector in three dimensions, and it will define a hyperplane where we can separate off the best point. So that's the second part to our training. So we want to find the W which gives us the best translations according to our criteria, and we want to think about how to represent our translation in terms of features such that we can actually find the best translation we're interested in. We can find a set of parameters that give us that translation. This second part is, so the first part we can refer to as optimization, optimizing our objective function. The second part, what we often call feature engineering. So here's our sort of summary of what we're thinking about in discriminative learning. So we have our linear model at the top, argmax of a nice linear model. And we can think of this as it's been shown here as a generalization and improvement of the noisy channel model, where we say, well, let's just not worry about the probabilistic explanation of this. Let's just think of it as features and weights. And then that frees us up to add all sorts of features that we might think are interesting. So then our final two key questions here that we have to answer is, well, what features should we choose? And where does W come from? How do we get W? So let's look at a small example. Man bites dog. So imagine we have this German input. Here is a n best list of English outputs for our sentence. And so we want to think about we want to come up with features that give us the good translation, which is in the bottom right. And this is pretty easy to do. You can look at these examples and think, well, there's sort of categories of errors that our system might make. So highlighted in blue, we could have errors of lexical choice. So cat is obviously a bad translation. Chase is a bad translation. So these are poor lexical choice. So we can think of that as one category of error. And we can think about designing features which improve the model's ability to make better lexical choices. A second type of error is a reordering error. So here we've got the right words in the wrong order. So that's the second type of error that we can think about. Let's design some features which allow the model to learn what is a good ordering, what is a good transduction of the input structure to the output structure, and what is a bad one. A third type of error that we might look at is what we might call a grammatical error, or an error of agreement, in that we're outputting words that give us ungrammatical output. So we might be missing a plural or things like that. And obviously what we want to do is let the model be able to identify our reference translation, our goal there. So as I said, we can think of these, attacking this question of choosing the features, we can think of as categorizing these errors and to try and identify them. Identify features that can help us solve them. So we have the lexical choice. So lexical choice is sort of the most basic thing in translation, right? That's what our phrase table gives us, a set of parameters over possible translations. So we can think of augmenting that. We can think of a classic problem with lexical choice is sense. So we can think of trying to disambiguate senses based on the context that a word might appear in, or lots of things like that. So configuration and ordering. The classic, obviously our language model gives us a lot of power over having good ordering. But we can then also go to more expressive features where we might look at the input or output syntax and define features over what are good syntactic constructions or what are bad ones. This ordering, if we just look at the output, both of these are syntactic, but if we look at the transduction from the input to the output, one of them is going to be unlikely. And finally, the grammatical one, again, that we can look at syntax, or we can look at part of speech tags or morphological information and have features that identify good sequences of words and bad ones and all sorts of different things. So this is the basic feature engineering process. You think about your translation model, you look at its output, and then you try and identify features that are going to be able to identify the best translations. So formally, what does this look like? So there we have our translation. We have some words that we want to identify. So maybe we want to put a feature on this pair. And so here we've defined this, so H15.3, that's just saying that we have loads of features, so we might have 20,000 features, and this is the 15,342nd one. And it's a function of our input German G, our output English E, and this feature evaluates to 1 whenever we see Hund in the input and Cat in the output. And you can imagine that might be a feature that we want to learn negative weight for. So that will appear in our feature column. In our W column, we'll have a weight for this that we'll train. And we probably want to learn a negative weight, that those two shouldn't go together. And so we might define lots of these binary features. But just the way I've defined them here is not really adequate, because there's nothing saying that those two are actually in our output translation, we're saying they're translation. So obviously if we have the cat chase the dog, we will have cat and Hund occurring together, but we could have a perfectly good translation, so we wouldn't want to have a negative weight on that. So we need to make our feature functions a little bit more expressive. And so the obvious thing to do is to introduce more of our translation structure into our feature functions. And so here we have our alignment. So when we're outputting a translation from our decoder, we know what the alignment is. We don't just see the input sentence and the output sentence. We know that there was a phrasal correspondence that the decoder is outputting. So we add that to our feature function. That's A for alignment. So now we say that our features are functions of the input sentence, the input German G, the output E, and the alignment between them. And so now we can improve our feature function by saying, let's have this feature function fire or be set to 1 if these two words are output as translations of each other. And that solves our problem that if they occur but are not translations of each other, then we won't have our negative weight. And so this is our basic feature function. And in your Moses or in CDEC, you can have a generic interface for features like this, and you can define all sorts of things that are just functions of the input, the output, and the alignment between them. So if you do take CDEC or Moses and run them sort of stock standard, you'll get a standard set of features. And these have some connection to the noisy channel features that we mentioned earlier. So we have, of course, we have our language model there, log P of E. We also have what are called the forward and backward translations, log P of E given F, F given E, all these sorts of things. So you can see that those noisy channel features are in there. But we throw in other things. We throw in the number of words in the hypothesis. So that's not a probability, that's just an integer count. But that allows the model to learn a weight on whether it should bias towards producing more words or less words in the translations. And that's important for getting the length right, which we know is important for maximizing your blue score. But we can throw in other translations. So we have what are called lexical translation probabilities. And these are, you can think of these as smoothing. So many of our phrases that we see, we won't see very often. We might only see them once. But we can also look at the lexical probabilities of the words within those phrases under a model like IBM Model 1. So IBM Model 1, we can give an input phrase and output phrase and ask what is the probability of this pair of phrases, and Model 1 can give us back an lexical probability, and as long as the words inside the phrase are frequent, we'll get a good score. So we have these lexical probabilities that allow us to smooth the often sparse phrasal counts. And then we can throw in lots of other things, and we can have parameters on our reordering scores as well. So in our normal sort of stock standard open source decoder, we're going to have somewhere between maybe 8 and 15 of these basic features. And so now we have to answer this question of where does W come from? So once we've come up with some good features, we need to come up with a W. So we think of what we're doing here as inference in a hypothesis space. So we have a bunch of points. There are hypotheses. Some of these points we know are good translations, and that might be because they occur in our references. And we want to learn our W that in some way pick out the reference translations from all our hypotheses. And so the standard tool that we're going to use from our decoder is its ability to give us a maximum or a k-best list, a list of the k-maximum translations. And we can express that just by this argmax. There's the argmax at the top. That says give us the most probable output E and its alignment, because of course we want its alignment now for our features. And then we can generalize that to the, give us the k-best. So k might be 100 or 1,000. Give us the outputs and their alignments, which have the 100 best scores or the 1,000 best scores. And the nice thing is we can do this very efficiently. So anyone that's taken a first year CS course knows that we have lots of great dynamic programming algorithms, generalizations of Dijkstra's algorithm that maximize in the sorts of search space our translation models produce. And then we can also generalize those to algorithms that give us the k-best very efficiently. And this, of course, is a standard interface that many of you will be familiar with for Moses and CDEC and other open source decoders. You normally have a parameter that says, give me the 100 k-best. So we want to use those k-best as our hypothesis space and then do our inference, our optimization on those. So our first idea is we could do something called a conditional random field, which is just to say, let's have a probabilistic model that tries to maximize the probability of the reference that we see for a given input. Let's maximize the probability of the reference we see and minimize the probability of everything else. We could have a maximum margin model, which just says, let's make the gap between the reference that we see and all the other hypotheses as big as possible. And these are two basic machine learning algorithms, and you're seeing these in machine learning applied to all sorts of things. But in MT, these are not really adequate. And the key idea is that just picking out a single reference and maximizing that it doesn't seem like a sensible thing, because we know that there is no single maximum. This is not like document classification, where the document is either in the set we want or out of the set we want. Our reference is just one example of a good translation, of which there may be millions of others, millions of other perfectly good translations. So treating it as the one good, the one possible output, doesn't seem so sensible. So the key thing we want is some sense of partial credit. We want to say that if our translation is close to the reference, that should be better than a translation which is nowhere near the reference. And we can define close in all sorts of ways, but the obvious thing to do is to use our metric, the metric we want to optimize. Whether that's blue score or TER or anything like that, maybe we want to use that. So from a machine learning point of view, we can see this in a general sense as a cost function or a loss function, here with L for loss. So we think of this as a function that takes an output and a reference and says, what is the loss of having predicted that? And so normally, by definition, if we predict the reference, the loss should be 1. But if we predict something that's not the reference, then the loss shouldn't necessarily be 0. It should be proportional to how bad we think that possible translation is. And that we can define by something like the blue score. And then we want to optimize our model to minimize its loss. So now we might have our hypothesis space here of k-best list examples, here numbered. We might have our weight vector there. And then, with some nice little colors here, we might say, what is the loss of each one of these output hypotheses? What would be the, and that might be the inverse of the blue score. And so we see in this example that our points at the top right there have high loss. Our point at the bottom left there has low loss. So it's actually the one that we probably should be predicting, but our weight vector points in the wrong direction. So how can we fix that? So I'm going to quickly go through two optimization techniques. The first one is more recent. This is from a couple of years ago. And it's something called PRO, pairwise ranking optimization. Now, firstly, the key problem is that the machine learning problem that we've set up here is actually extremely difficult. So solving it exactly is not going to work. We can't just treat this as a training set optimize our loss happily and get a good set of weights. It's just too difficult a problem. So we have to simplify it somehow. We have to add some structure to make this doable. And what John May and Mark Hopkins up in the top right there suggested was to actually train our model as a pairwise ranker. And that is to say, if we take any two points from our MBEST list, we want to learn a function which tells us which of those two points, which of those two hypotheses is better. And so that's how we train it. We basically, for n iterations, we randomly select points. We calculate their cost function of those two points so we can decide which one's better. And then we update our w so that we prefer the better one over the poorer one. And so the nice thing about this is that we've reduced this complicated machine learning optimization to learning a binary classifier. And we're really good at learning binary classifiers. That's easy. And there's lots of standard open source toolkits for doing that. So that's the main motivation here, is to take this really complicated problem and make it something simple that we can throw standard tools at. So if we have this set of hypotheses colored by their losses, and we choose one, and we choose another one, and it's worse under our loss function, then we create a training instance with that as a negative example in our training space, and we keep doing this, select another pair, this one's better, so that becomes a positive example in our training space, and we collect up lots of these, and we end up with a set of positive and negative examples that we can then throw at a stock standard binary classifier and say learn a binary decision function which separates negative from positive. And so there we go, and we can see that that should be, in this nice two-dimensional example, should be pretty easy. We can learn that linear function that separates those two classes. And that will give us a vector W. And then we can predict that vector W back onto our hypotheses, and because that vector W gives us a pairwise ranker, it gives us a function, if we compare any two points, it can tell us which one's better, and therefore now we can order our k-best list under that function and decide which one's the best. So that's a very simple, essentially a very simple algorithm for learning W, which just uses the stock standard tools that we have available to us. It uses a k-best output of our open source decoder. It uses some off-the-shelf binary classifier and gives us a W that allows us to learn, to optimize for our loss function. And so the only thing we need, the only requirement that we have here is that our loss function can be calculated for each training instance, each sentence. And that is a bit of a limitation, because if we think about our most popular loss function, the blue score, it's corpus-based, it's not sentence-based. It's actually a non-linear function of the sentences, so you can't take individual scores from the sentences and combine them to get the score for the corpus. It's a non-linear function. So to apply this model to the blue score, we actually have to approximate the loss function. We have to approximate blue at a sentence level. And you'll see that referred to as sentence blue. And because if we just look at a single sentence, our n-gram statistics are much sparser, our sentence level blue tends to be a bit less well-behaved than our corpus level blue. But still, this works quite well. So that we make a bit of a sacrifice for our loss function, but we get a nice, easy-to-implement, easy-to-apply learning algorithm that does actually scale to reasonable sized, it scales to big training sets and it scales to significant numbers of features. Okay, so that was pro. So the second algorithm I'll talk about is what's called minimum error rate training that was proposed about 10 years ago by Franz up there. Now, MERT is, or has been, by far the most dominant discriminative training algorithm in machine translation. So the vast majority of times you'd run an open source translation decoder, it will optimize with minimum error rate training. So the nice thing about MERT is it directly optimizes pretty much any loss function. Not any loss function, but it can definitely do blue at the corpus level. The downside is it doesn't really scale to a significant number of features. So once you get above about 20 features, and as I said, we might like to have thousands, but once you get above 20, MERT starts to not work so well. And that's why, when I put up that slide of standard features, we have this standard set of features that's somewhere between 8 and 15, because that's pretty much the limit we could do with MERT. There's lots of features we'd like to throw in, but minimum error rate training wouldn't deal with it. And you'll see why in a moment. So given our linear model and any hypothesis, we can score that hypothesis and get some score M. So imagine we have W, and imagine I give you another vector V, and I say that is a search direction. We say, I want to go in the direction V from W, starting at W, let's go in the direction V until we get the maximum blue score. So this is a one-dimensional search problem along V. So we just assume someone's given us V. I'll come back to that in a moment. Now if we look at that, we're saying that we're looking for a new set of weights that are W plus some multiple of V. So gamma there is a scalar. So a one-dimensional optimization. If we expand this, there's our feature functions. Let's expand the sum. And we can notice that this is a nice linear function. We have M, our score for any hypothesis, is a linear function of our existing weights and gamma times our new direction. So why is that useful? Yes, nice linear 2D function. Why is that useful? So if we think about the function M versus gamma for a single hypothesis, it's a linear function, it's a line. So that means as we change gamma, our function M moves along this line. Now if we have a k-best list, we have lots of these lines. So we have one line for each hypothesis. Now, assuming that we're trying to maximize the score, M, we can look at the highest parts of the lines on this graph are the maximums. So if we pick that out, we can see that there's this upper envelope of maximums where on the left, this line that corresponds to a particular hypothesis is a maximum. In the middle, we switch to a different hypothesis, and then on the right, we have a third one. And so if we're trying to maximize this function, we can see that it's going to be a piecewise linear function of our linear scores there. So how do we use that? So the next thing we can observe is that if we have our loss function like blue or something like that that we're optimizing, it's going to be constant as long as we're predicting the same translation. As long as I'm outputting the same translation, my loss is not going to change. So on the left there, the loss is going to be constant, then it's going to change in the middle and be constant for a little segment, and then it's going to change again and be constant. So our piecewise linear function, if we look at the errors, is going to become a piecewise constant function. So at the bottom is going to be our loss function. So we see that it's constant as long as we're predicting E162 up there. Then as E28 becomes the maximum, we switch to it and we have a jump. And then as we predict E73, we have another jump. So this is quite nice behavior because we can search this piecewise constant function very easily. Now if we have another reference, imagine we've got this envelope from a different set of sentences, sorry, for a different sentence, we can then basically just project its errors onto the previous sentences and get the sum, and we can keep doing this to get the errors for our whole corpus. That's assuming that we can boil our error function down to some sufficient statistics. And for something like blue, we can, because the sufficient statistics for it are just the n-gram counts, the precisions, and the lengths. So we can build this error function, this piecewise constant error function, up for our whole corpus, and we can search it exactly, very quickly, and we can find a minimum. So our loss is minimum at that little highlighted point there. We'll call that gamma star, and then our new weights are just gamma star times V plus W. So that's how we update W. So that's a very... So I've skipped over how we actually do that piecewise constant search, but the key thing is that we can do it, and we can do it optimally. So we can guarantee that we're getting the best gamma. So that's great. We can optimize complicated loss functions like blue that almost any other machine learning technique can't optimize. But we can only do it for a small number of features. And the reason we can only do it for a small number of features is because we don't know what direction V to go in. So in some sense, I like to characterize minimum error rate training as half an optimization technique. It's this great optimal search which doesn't know which direction to go in. And so the standard solution is to randomly pick a vector V, search in that direction, randomly pick another vector v, search in that direction, do this lots of times, compare and take the one that's best. Now, why that's not such a good idea is that as the number of parameters increases, a random direction in 2D, you only have to pick a few of those before you'll find one that's good. A random direction in a million dimensions, you're going to have to pick a lot of random vectors before you find a good direction. So that's a big problem with MERT. It's a line search algorithm in need of a direction to go in. So MERT works for small numbers of features when we can randomly select enough vectors to have a good chance of getting one in a positive direction. But as soon as we scale the number of features, the chance that we'll choose a good direction goes down and down and down. And so something that hasn't been looked at but a great area for research is to choose better directions for MERT. There's been a little bit of research. So standard in machine learning, we'd use the gradient to tell us which direction to go in. But we can't get the gradient of any of these functions, and that's why this is difficult. Okay, so that's it for the very reasonably high level coverage of discriminative training. And so we finish with a little summary to try and combine talk about evaluation at the start and discriminative training to say that these two things are linked. And the takeaway message at the end here is that we can, if we want to improve translation, well, we need good discriminative training algorithms, but we need good evaluation metrics to optimize as well. You can have the best optimization algorithm in the world, but if your metric is bad, you'll get bad translations from that. So that's a key thing. And these two need to be developed in tandem, because it's also no good having a great evaluation metric that you can't optimize. Well, it's good for scoring your translations at the end, but we'd really like to be able to optimize it. So when coming up with evaluation metrics, it's good to think about whether they're linear or non-linear in the sentences, what their sufficient statistics are, will these break down in a nice way that I can put them inside an optimizer and get a good result. So they're linked. So I'll leave you with that that summary, and thank you.
That's close to the reference, but for the rest you don't care. But like if you want to do rescoring later on, you would actually care that the whole top of the MBES list is good. And yeah, this is like...
Yeah, so, and that's a quite an important question. This comes back to the, as I said, some people, you often see people refer to in a recent paper say that they're doing a logarithmic model and they're optimizing probability distribution. And what you're saying is true, they're not. So MERP is an optimizer, a linear classifier. That is, all it cares about is the one prediction being good according to the metric. And so there's good reasons why we might actually care about the distribution over translations so that we can look deeper than the one best. And MERP doesn't give us that. Neither does a linear model. So you do actually have to optimize something like a logarithmic model or some sort of probabilistic model if you want probabilities. You can't take what MERP gives you and say those are the probabilities.
Does MERP mean to be regularized because there could be a lot of correlated predictors?
Yeah, so there've been a number of papers on regularizing MERP, and I always scratch my head when I see that. Because as I said, so normally regularization becomes an issue when you have lots of sparse features to allow you to overfit translations. But that is, you can go from so imagine you've got a sentence pair in your data which is just not translations. We often get these. If you have lots of sparse features, you can learn to produce something that's not a translation just by putting weights on those. But that only happens when you have lots of features, and we never use lots of features. You can't overfit with 10 features. I've yet to see any evidence that someone can overfit with 10 features. So the big problem with MERP is search. We can't do optimal search. So it's very unlikely we'll ever overfit if we can't optimally search. So when someone comes up with a way to do the search optimally, then we'll jack up the number of features, then we'll need regularization. But until that happens, I don't really believe that we need to regularize 10 features.